Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Inside Asia podcast from the Center for Asian Democracy at the University of Louisville. This is Dave Buckley, CAD's director, and Paul Weber, endowed chair in politics, science, and religion here in the political science department. We are back today with a bit of an unexpected episode, and we'll talk about why. Unexpected, not in the sense that we're back with another episode, but that 3 weeks ago, we might not have been thinking about Japan as being at the top of our agenda, but a really interesting couple of weeks there gives us the chance to focus in on that. Before we start, I want to say thanks for production of this episode to our great colleague, Cherith Kaufman, and also to take the chance to thank Cherith for her work here as she moves on for a great opportunity elsewhere at the university. Cherith, we've appreciated your work with the center for sure, and we'll miss you, but we're glad you're not going too far. Inside Asia podcast is accessible through our website at the University of Louisville, as well as through Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search Center for Asian Democracy. Subscribe, review, and stay up to date on future content. Today, we are joined by Dr. Charles McLean of Yale University for a discussion on Japan's recently completed national election. Just within the last week, Japan, in an early election, a snap election, returned a result that at least took most analysts by surprise. It's not quite right to say that it was a loss for the governing LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, which has governed Japan for almost all of its post-World War II history. But it certainly wasn't the result they were hoping for. And so Charlie is going to bring some of his expertise to help us understand what happened in the election, the likely outcomes, and why the LDP might have underachieved, and also who's in a stronger position coming out of this election. We spend a particular chunk of time also talking about what I think is probably the most important feature of Japan's democracy in terms of the broader health of democracy internationally, Japan's status as what Charlie calls a silver democracy and others call a silver democracy, a democracy where older politicians and voters have a tremendous amount of influence, and where conversely, we see relatively fewer younger politicians and lower levels of political participation among younger voters. So we'll talk about how Charlie's research fits into understanding questions of youth participation in Japan and abroad as well. Charles McLean is assistant professor of political science at Yale University. He conducts research in comparative politics with a focus on the politics of age, and in particular, a focus on Japan. His work has been published already at this stage in his career in leading journals like the British Journal of Political Science, Comparative Political Studies, Political Behavior, and others. He has a spectacular book manuscript in process, Silver Democracy, Youth Representation in an Aging Japan, that explores the causes and consequences of youth underrepresentation in democracies. His research has been featured in various news outlets, both in Japan and internationally, including The Economist, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and others. Charlie has previously been a Toyota visiting professor at the University of Michigan Center for Japanese Studies. He was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's program on U.S.-Japan relations, and has prior affiliations at the Council on Foreign Relations and as a Fulbright Fellow at Kobe University. So Charlie is a perfect voice to help us make sense both of the short-term outcomes of this election and also what it means long-term for the health of Japan's democracy. So without any further ado, let's get to my conversation with Professor Charles McLean. All right. Well, Charles McLean, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
We're actually recording, so listeners know, on the morning after Halloween, which is not always the easiest time to get out of bed and get going. So I appreciate, Charlie, you taking the time pretty close to the election. So the international story here has been framed as sort of a defeat for the LDP, right? Certainly falling well short of what they were hoping to get in the October 27th elections. Things are a little bit more complicated than that, though. Can you maybe just get us started by summing up the overall result, but also kind of where things stand today in relation to the governing coalition and likely next negotiation steps?
Sure, and thank you again for having me here today. So I think it was a surprise to quite a few of us, especially looking at it from outside Japan. that the LDP Komeito ruling coalition did come up short. This just hasn't happened very often before. Since the LDP formed in 1955, you know, it's ruled but for all but 4 years since then. And the only times it really came up short in terms of capturing a majority, say, with its coalition was, you know, 1993, 2009, and then now for the first time in 15 years, 2024. So it's always surprising. It doesn't happen often. And this situation is especially interesting because we're waiting to see. So when an election happens, the Japanese Constitution essentially says that within 30 days after the election, you need to convene the lower house. And at that meeting, the lower house has to vote on a prime minister. And I think what we're trying to see is, can the LDP and Komeito bring like a third party into the coalition? Is that what's going to happen? Like a more formal coalition that's going to allow the LDP to govern, allow Ishiba to stay in office? Or could we possibly even see maybe like minority government, which is very rare in Japan, has maybe only happened for a brief period. Since the post-war, since the LDP came to power, which would mean we wouldn't have a party formally join the coalition, but maybe we'd get somebody to sort of either vote for Ishiba or allow Ishiba to come to the fore, and we'd see these, what we might call a ad hoc kind of coalition. So we'd have parties joining together to pass particular legislation, but then other than that, they wouldn't be like a real formal member of the LDP Komeito coalition. So we're all eager to see what happens when the lower house convenes. Can Ishiba hold on to his job? Will we see a formal, you know, three-party coalition or four-party coalition, or will we actually see minority government? And what would that mean going forward?
But it seems like it's pretty unlikely to you that we would actually see an opposition-led coalition. I mean, obviously the LDP still comes in kind of in the lead position here, and that seems pretty much likely that they'll still be in the overall driver's seat.
Yes. So the LDP didn't win a majority together with this coalition, but unlike 2009, in this situation, the LDP still won a plurality of seats. It still won the most seats. And the ruling coalition is still has a lot of seats. They don't have enough to get to that sort of magic number of 233. And even if they bring in back in the independents, so there was some, we could talk about this in a minute, but there were some LDP members who were kind of, you know, kicked out of the party because of their involvement with the slush fund scandal. And there was lots of discussion about would LDP Komeito plus forgiving those people involved in the slush fund scandal be enough for 233, but it isn't. And to your question, David, you know, technically the numbers are there that the opposition parties, technically, if they all banded together, could cross that magic number of 233. But we have to remember that although sometimes we'll call them the opposition, you know, they vary quite widely in ideological stance. And so it's hard to imagine really like, you know, leftist parties joining together with very conservative parties to sort of go against the LDP. If anything, to me, that seems even less unstable, I mean, less likely and less stable than, say, LDP Komeito plus a third party.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So I know it's relatively early here. We're just kind of a couple of days after the voting. But do you have any sense for sort of under the hood a little bit how this result came to pass? Any trends in early looks at the returns that stand out? That could be geographically underachieving, but also sort of demographically. Do we have a sense for where the LDP fell the shortest in this race?
Yes. So before we had this lower house election, we of course had the leadership election for the party leadership of the LDP. And that was also a very interesting race and a very unpredictable race, which is unusual in Japanese politics. Traditionally, you used to have, say, strong factions, for example, that would sort of get together behind, faction leaders would get together behind closed doors and make sort of agreements about who should sort of take on the next role of the prime minister. And the party leadership election wouldn't be so unpredictable, wouldn't be so contested. But one of the outcomes of this slush fund scandal was, it's a story we've been hearing for a year about, you know, sort of the fallout from the slush fund scandal. But an immediate impact was that then Prime Minister Fumio Kishida thought that, you know, the public is really associating these traditional factions with this, like, you know, these slush fund scandals. And it was really like the you know, Abe faction in particular, but many factions were involved. And so he dissolved them, right? He got rid of the factions, at least formally, and all but one formally dissolved. And so, flash forward to September when we have the party leadership election, suddenly you don't have factions sort of pulling strings behind the closed doors. Now, I'm not saying that the faction leaders or big bosses still weren't influential, but it was a much more open race, right? And so out of this came to the fore somebody, Shigeru Ishiba wins, who had run for the leadership contest. This was his fifth time. Right, he is not everyone, especially international news, you always hear that he's not particularly popular within the LDP. And he does come from what we might call the more reformist wing of the party, but he came into office with a really difficult, like really divided party, where you have a sort of reformist wing that Kishida kind of belongs to, and a more conservative wing that's led especially by like Taro Aso. And so Ishiba is not popular among his party, but he's popular with the public. At least that was the thought. And so going into the election, there was a sort of expectation that, well, maybe Ishiba's going to have difficulty, bridging a divided party, but he's going to be popular with the public. But that really didn't last very long, and it wasn't as strong as we thought. And I think part of it is because, I'm not sure exactly what, of course, what Ishiba's thinking was during this process, but during the campaign for the party's leadership post, he tried to really present himself as a reformer. And you try to highlight that he would really be the one to take down sort of like this, address these slush fund scandals, take a much, harder line in sort of reforming the party. But there's a real strong impression that after he won the office, he kind of backed off a lot of this. And, he did kick out people from the party, but he seemed more open to bringing some of them back in. Some of the more reform-minded policy proposals he had, he sort of quote unquote flip-flopped on. And so I think that there's a part of it that the public just didn't really, whatever they thought of Ishiba personally, they didn't view this process as the LDP really seriously, being committed to reform, right? So at least whatever, the messiness of the process did not convey to the public. And so I think that's pretty clear in public opinion polling afterward, that the public just did not see this outcome as a serious commitment of the LDP to address these big, slush fund issues. I think that's part of it. And I think another surprising part, which we could get more into, is how popular certain parties were, even smaller parties. So lots of people are talking about the Democratic Party for the People, sometimes called DPFP or DPP. I'm going to call them DPP. They performed a lot better than expected. And they did a particularly good job in going after like the youth vote. And that was unexpected. We don't really have, let's say, young people, I don't know, being disenchanted with the LDP and flocking to the strongest opposition party, the CDPJ. Instead, they went toward this like smaller party, and we could get more into that. But I think that's another trend that was unexpected. Of course, the CDPJ, the main opposition party, gained seats. But that's not the only flow that happened in this election. It's not only from LDP to like CDPJ. It's quite different, I feel like, than 2009, where you saw the DPJ, sort of really capture a lot of the anti-LDP vote. I think that story is a little bit more complicated this time.
So if you had to talk about kind of winners coming out of this, okay, so the main opposition does have some gains. You see the
Yes.
DPP also as one of the other kind of relative winners coming out of this. Are there any other parties that sort of wake up this morning and find themselves in a having a lot more leverage than they did a week ago?
Well, I think I would like to highlight Noda as sort of the head of the CDPJ. I mean, he certainly is going to come out as a winner. He was previously prime minister just for a year. And we used to talk about the revolving door of like prime ministers in Japan, right? And prime ministers in Japan would typically last only 1 year. And after we had this like long tenure in the early 2000s of Junichiro Koizumi, we went through 6 years of six prime ministers. First 3 years of three LDP prime ministers, then 3 years of three DPJ prime ministers, and the last one before Abe came back and had this, longest tenure in Japanese history was Noda. And so he was the last person to sort of have that, I don't want to say short-shrifted, but not really have a real chance to have as much of an impact as he was hoping on Japanese politics. And so I know you were asking about smaller parties, but I think he definitely comes out as a winner from this election because he's back. Right. And he's led the opposition to unseating, not totally unseating the LDP, but this tremendous victory. And so I definitely think that there's a story there. Yes, I do think we could also talk about the sort of interesting story, just focusing on persons, first of all, of Yuichiro Tamaki, who's the leader of the DPP. And again, I think it's because this party captured, I believe, 28 seats. And, really there's this perception that the party is sort of in the kingmaker position, or that they've got a lot of leverage and they're being kind of courted both by the left side and the conservative side, by the LDP. And whether or not, as I said, they formally join the coalition, they may be able to extract a variety of sort of policy concessions, by their like fortuitous position. But that's been the focus. I mean, we're still only, as you said, David, a couple days after the election. Things can change quickly. But it's been interesting to me that people have focused more on DPP and not on, say, like Isshin no Kai, which was, if we flash back to 2021, the last election, we would have all been saying that Isshin no Kai was the third force in Japanese politics. This like regional party based in Osaka, they were in relatively conservative, but also kind of populist. And we would have thought maybe Isshin no Kai was going to be a real, either the third force or possibly partner with the LDP. And I'm sure they're in conversations with Ishiba now. But it's been interesting to me that the real focus has been on this DPP as sort of a more policy focused, managed to capture the youth vote, outperformed, and with this charismatic leader of Yuichiro Tamaki as being, perhaps the decisive factor in whatever form the next Japanese government takes.
That's great. One thing we like to do in these conversations is talk about the research that folks have done to that bears on the events we're talking about. And you've looked at Japanese snap elections in the past, and the
Yes.
impact of unexpected elections in a really cool piece. And this was a snap election. I gather it was partial. Its timing was at least partially tied to the kind of slush fund scandals that we'll talk more about in just a minute. But just in general, like as you look at some of the dynamics tied to snap elections and how in theory they should play because they're not required to the incumbent party, how do you look at this election as fitting in with how we understand snap elections and how they work in Japan?
Yeah, so I think just for our listeners, I want to highlight, as we get ready for the US election too, that the Japan has what we might call like a flexible election calendar, not fixed election dates, right? So in many presidential systems, the date of the election is known. In the US, we have presidential elections every 4 years, House elections every 2 years. It's set, and the election date is always, that Tuesday in November. But in Japan and in many parliamentary systems, it's really up to the prime minister to decide, when the election is held. They have a lot of power to dissolve parliament and suddenly call, as David was saying, a snap election or a surprise election. And as he was kindly referencing my research, I had shown that in the past, LDP governments in particular, I mean, governments in Japan, but really it's typically LDP governments, have been able to use this power to their electoral advantage, right? And many studies have sort of focused on how parties use this power to say, wait for the economy to be doing really well, or wait for them to be like a maximization, strategy, right? Let's wait for the economy to be doing really well, or let's wait for our party to be particularly popular, and we'll time the election for that, and we'll sort of reap the associated electoral rewards. What I had actually talked about in my article was the ability of parties in power to catch opposition parties by surprise. Because actually, one thing that was interesting about this election was it was one of the shortest, I think it's the shortest period in post-war history between calling an election and when the election was held. It's very quick. I think it was just 21 days this time. I could be off on the number, but it was very fast. And so that ability to just really suddenly call an election, I argued, gives incumbent parties this ability to sort of, catch the opposition when they're not ready, make it difficult for the opposition to coordinate. And this historically has benefited from the LDP. So all
Especially when
that
the
said,
opposition is fragmented, you would think that would be
especially,
right.
absolutely, when the opposition is fragmented. So all that to say, this time it seems to have backfired, right? Or at least that's it. I think if we looked at sort of headlines across international papers in Japan, a lot of them are basically saying this snap election backfired. So why didn't it work this time? So I think I would say two things. So one is that it may not have been that surprising to the opposition. I know we like to call this a sort of surprising snap election, but I was very much predicting that an election would happen because we just had the LDP leadership election in September. And we have an upper house election coming next July. The lower house election at the latest needed to be called by fall 2025. So there was just a year left. And historically, there's a sort of pattern or, it's a common thing when a new prime minister comes to the fore, they want to seek a kind of electoral mandate from voters. And so the opposition may have thought that there was actually a much higher likelihood that an election would happen. They may have been kind of gearing up for this, knowing that as soon as Kishida said he was resigning, they may have felt like an election was coming. And it does seem like this time we didn't see the opposition all banding together, but they seem to have coordinated a bit better. And we didn't see the opposition sort of losing out as they used to in the past as much from sort of failures to coordinate. So I think that's part of it. The other part, and I know this is, we will never know. It's a counterfactual, I suppose. But we don't know how Ishiba would have fared if he waited a year or waited 6 months. Actually, this might have been the best possible outcome. We don't know. Japanese governments over time, historically, tend to decline in popularity. There's a little bit of like a honeymoon period when you come to the fore. And then, when you first take office, and then over time, popularity tends to sort of slowly decline and other scandals can come up. And so, if you're thinking, if you put yourself in Ishiba's shoes, there aren't that many windows over the next year in which to call a snap election. And he may have felt like this was his best chance. And we'll never know. But it's perhaps, it could have been possible that if he waited longer, the LDP would have done even worse. We won't know. So, I understand the thinking that went into it, why he called it now. It's what I thought would happen, but it does seem to have backfired in the sense that the opposition this time around has performed much better than in the past.
Yeah, but counterfactual thinking, right? It's
Yes.
always the right way to be doing this. That's good social scientists. Okay, so we've danced around this a bunch, but this kind of slush fund scandal that seems to
Yes.
have played a part in the timing of the election, and then maybe the week showing too. For listeners who are curious, we actually did a great episode last year with Levi McLaughlin, particularly on the kind of religious aspects of controversies tied to the LDP and to the assassination of Shinzo Abe. So you can check that out. It was really fascinating to me. I knew nothing about this before that conversation. These scandals clearly seem to have mattered in the context of this campaign. I guess kind of two questions. One, just could you really quickly give folks a little bit of context for what that looked like? What do we mean by slush fund and campaign contributions and that sort of thing? And also, I mean, is the scan do you think that this has kind of run its course at this point in time, that the LDP has been punished and then this is kind of likely to kind of fade away, or is this really going to continue to internally disrupt the party's ability to have a cohesive internal leadership and appeal to voters outside?
Yes, thank you. Both great questions. So, a little bit more about the slush fund scandal. So, if for any of our listeners who have sort of followed Japanese elections in the past, or if you're new to it, one characteristic is that Japan has really tight regulations on basically every dimension of conducting an election campaign, right? Advertising, campaign finance, what candidates, how they spend money, I mean, just all of this is very tightly controlled, and there's very clear rules about, the way elections should be conducted. And there's different perspectives on this. So one thing that has often been said is that, Japan is famous for having very strict election regulations. And what happened with this slush fund scandal is that the Abe faction was particularly at the center of this, is that the faction was collecting, a lot of fundraising sort of on the side, skirting these like reporting laws and creating this slush fund, this sort of pocket of money that could then be used by, they say, the faction's candidates or the faction itself to benefit themselves electorally, right? So they were really circumventing the law and, giving themselves a tremendous advantage by being able to use all this off-the-books money. When this scandal came out, again, I mentioned earlier, it was really, it really soured public opinion on the factions. I don't want to say that the factions were ever particularly popular among the public. And, the public, or let's say younger members of the LDP, both the public and younger party members tended to view factions as sort of anti-democratic. I mentioned previously that faction bosses, for example, in deciding like leadership positions or cabinet positions, would sort of go behind closed doors and make a lot of the senior personnel decisions without really consulting younger members. It wasn't an open process. And then they would essentially whip their faction members, right, into sort of complying and voting the way they said. And I talked about how this time around, as you know, as Kishida come, you know, basically is trying to deal with, you know, this widespread distrust of the LDP and real anger at this sort of slush fund scandal, which I think built on some of the scandals you were talking about as well, David, like the LDP's ties to the Unification Church. You know, I think that these, it's just kind of increasing levels of public dissatisfaction with the LDP. And so Kishida tried to sort of blow up these factions, and we're still living in the fallout of that. And we're still not really clear, you know, what comes next. So to get to your second question, it's always difficult for political scientists. We always hesitate to like predict what's coming in the future. I don't know how much we're going to continue to talk about the slush fund scandal, but I don't think we're done with the story about picking up the pieces about sort of how the LDP is going to function going forward. We're still in a situation where it's, for a lot of us Japan observers outside and within Japan, it isn't clear how destroyed the factions are. They were destroyed in the past and they've come back. Are they operating behind the scenes? Are they going to come back in force to sort of pick up the pieces here, or are they really gone? And we're going to see a more, we'll say democratic, but a more open process of sort of deciding leadership going forward. I think that the LDP itself still has to reconcile with like what kind of party it's going to be going forward. How serious is it about reform? Is it really going to reform to win back public opinion? Is it going to kind of pretend to reform or try to change the conversation until, as you hinted at, David, maybe people forget or something new comes to the fore? I'm not sure. And I think that's what we're all looking at. I think Ishiba, at least in his statements, would like to more seriously reform the party. But again, I don't, you know, when I talked about him backtracking or sort of flip-flopping on issues before, I'm not sure how much of that is sort of his internal, you know, uncertainty about public policy or what the party should do, as much as he's just torn between, you know, how do I manage a party that's split at the moment? And so for those of us hoping maybe for more significant reform, I'm concerned that the sort of internal split within the party are going to make it difficult. And so I guess we're all looking at, is this enough of a shock, right? Is the loss of the election enough of a shock to make more serious reform possible?
Yeah. So I wanted to pivot a little bit, although it's related to this question about sort of internal accountability and voter response to the LDP. Just in general, voter turnout was not especially strong in this election by Japanese standards, right? Although, you know, we should always remember as Americans, it was still about 54%. So this is not something that's down in the 20s or 30s, but still one of the lower turnouts we've had recently. We probably expect some of that in a snap election or an early election, just maybe because of lack of campaign preparedness or whatever, but it could also indicate a kind of general disengagement or dissatisfaction with voters, and there's at least been some journalistic coverage of that. I don't know, how do you interpret that turnout number in context of other recent elections?
I think highlighting, you know, political disengagement is really important, and something that I'm glad you were pointing out some really good journalistic coverage that has pointed to that, but sometimes we kind of overlook it because we focus on the voters, we focus on the people who are really angry or the people who are dissatisfied or turning to, like I said, young voters turning to the DPP. And so we read afterwards that now the DPP, this, you know, third party, managed to capture the youth vote. And like, this is what young people want. But we really should couch that with most young people are staying home. Right, in these elections in particular, turnout is low, and then Japan absolutely has, you know, different turnout rates by, say, age, decade, with people in their, you know, 20s or like 18 to 29 having the lowest turnout rate. So I haven't looked at this. Sometimes it takes a minute for the specific youth turnout rate to sort of come out, but I imagine that it's going to be the lowest, and it might be in like the 30s, right, 30%. So again, when we say when you read these headlines, you know, listeners, and you hear like so-and-so captured the youth vote or so-and-so lost the youth vote, we do have to remember that 70% of young people are not engaged, right? Not turning out to vote, even though Japan actually has, you know, essentially automatic voter registration. So they don't have like some of the issues that we have here in the US with getting young people registered to vote. right? There should be lower barriers for young people to vote, but they're still not turning out to vote. So I think when I look at the turnout numbers afterward, it makes me want to sort of, change the story or alter the story a little bit to say that it's not only, when we have government behaving this way and you have slush fund scandals, the only response or the only protest response isn't necessarily to vote for the opposition. It can also be to disengage, right? To not turn out in elections. And that's problematic for all sorts of reasons and something that's probably worth a lot more study. We shouldn't only focus on sort of who got the votes, but really like who's not voting and who's being turned off by this type of politics.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, now we really do kind of pivot to the core of your research agenda that you've been developing related to youth and participation in democracy in general, and especially in Japan. You just talked a little bit about turnout on the voter side. You've also got a lot of research on the candidate side and who wins election and how do younger candidates fare in the Japanese system. Maybe I could first off just ask you to look at this election and then we could step back. In this election, is there any evidence, maybe outside of kind of the leadership of the DPP, is there any sort of broader pattern that you see in terms of younger candidates or next generation candidates having some success coming out of this election campaign?
Yes. So before I talk about the picture for young people, which is a little bit less rosy, I do want to highlight one, more. I mean, all this could be considered as positive or negative, but I do want to highlight one positive note of this election, which is that it saw more women win seats than any election in the post-war history. Right. So close to 16% women. It topped the number in 2009. 16% or 15.8% is not, close to gender parity, but for Japan and for the lower house, that's quite stark, right? It was a large increase. And the reason I want to highlight that too, I mean, I think it's wonderful, but also to sort of contrast it with, we didn't see a similar surge among young people running for office this time. So if I showed you, for example, a chart that had all of the OECD countries, and we wanted to look at what percent of members in the low in their lower houses or unicameral chambers are, let's say, under 40 years old? What you would see on that chart is that Japan is second to last in the OECD. It before the election, it had just 5%, or in the last election, just 5% of members were under 40. After this election, it's 6%. So, I mean, you could say that's a 20% increase, and I don't mean that as a joke. It is going up, but it's not a lot, right? Now I'll say that, and the only country that has fewer young people in office than Japan is South Korea, and right after Japan is us here in the United States. So we also have a problem. Less than 10% of members are under 40, right? So this has been, I think there's a lot there's interesting reasons why it's increasing so much on the women's side and why gender equality is sort of progressing well. I think there's a lot more sort of like grassroots activism in trying to encourage more women to run for office, not just at the national level, but in local office as well. And I think that exists for young people, but it's newer and is a little bit less developed. So I do think that, unfortunately, one story of this election is that it wasn't really a new surge of young candidates that were sort of the story of this particular election. I will say that I believe the CDPJ, the main opposition party, has the most young MPs, perhaps followed by the LDP. I'm not 100% sure of that. But I do think that, we saw just a sort of small uptick on the youth representation or young people running for office side this time around.
Could you maybe give a sense of your argument about this? Because I think it's actually an important distinction. Some people might say, oh, okay, well, I don't know. It must be just that in some societies, kind of voters don't want younger candidates, right? That it's a demand explanation. That's essentially not what you are arguing in your research. So just give folks a little bit of context for why you think we consistently see this pattern over time in certain countries.
Yes, when I started working on this, I think for those listeners who are familiar with Japan, you may know that age-based hierarchies are sort of really common throughout the country. They're in politics. Japan has really strong seniority systems, which tie back into the factions where, you don't get to be in senior office level, you don't get to be in the cabinet or become prime minister until you've won, say, eight times. And so you don't have young people sort of in more leadership positions, but also, you know, at work, at schools, in social organizations, you see a lot of age-based hierarchy. And so you don't usually see young people in positions of power, say, over older people. And so when I was starting this research, I thought, as David was suggesting, you know, maybe Japan is just a country where they feel a little uncomfortable, you know, type of ageism about having young representatives. But really what I've shown like in work I've published is that if anything, among other countries, you know, Japan has some of the strongest positive attitudes toward young candidates. And Japanese voters, both younger voters and older voters, dislike gerontocracy. They don't like, Japan's word is sometimes, you know, silver democracy. They don't like the fact that there aren't young people in office. And in surveys and observational data, they show over and over again that if we can encourage more young people to run, voters will be very positive toward young people for a number of reasons, including, and this maybe ties back into what we're talking about with the slush funds, is that right or wrong, younger candidates are viewed as bringing more change and as more likely to tackle sort of like corruption issues, as less likely to be corrupt themselves, you know, changing like the face of the party. And so that's part of it. Also more likely to focus on many policy issues. More the voters think that these younger candidates will tackle childcare, education, climate change. So I think that there's a number of things that make younger candidates actually popular. And so as David was suggesting, it isn't really a demand story. I think it's more of a supply story. It isn't that voters dislike young candidates in Japan or don't want to see young candidates. I think the challenge we're going to have, or Japan is going to have, is can they create change institutions or change something about maybe the way in which young people are socialized into politics that can encourage more young people to sort of seek public office.
You mentioned the policy differences that young candidates might bring to their approach, especially the kind of social spending, which is very contentious in Japan because the society is sort of demographically so tilted to the older demographics. Coming out of this election campaign, did that kind of social policy debate play much of a role on the trail? Did some of, like, for instance, the DPP, did they talk in these terms and sort of policy terms about changes that need to be made in the state's approach to social spending that might be relevant to serving younger communities?
I do think that there is a story about why the DPP. So I'll say that, you know, I'm still analyzing the election results, but I think that as of today, as of this first week, I think there's two stories we could tell about why the DPP was so successful in sort of getting after the youth vote. And I think one of them is exactly what David's suggesting, which is I think the DPP was successful in portraying itself as more policy oriented, but not so much, in my impression, in the social spending category, which is interesting, not so much in it being, they're still a, you know, a somewhat conservative party. And so this wasn't a necessarily campaigning on, we need to increase child welfare spending for younger families or make it easier for sort of women to work. There was a part to that, but I think that the stronger policy message they put across was actually about Japan's kind of like stagnant wages. And so I think they talked a lot about how do we increase take-home pay, for example. How do we, and I think there was a, you know, a thing about that for even households where both parents work, but I think that it was more economic to me. I mean, social spending is economic as well, but I just mean that a more general, how do we do policies that basically affect your daily life, your pocketbook, the amount of money you take home. And I think they were pretty strong about saying things like not just wages, but sort of like take home pay, right? After tax, how much money are you bringing home? I think that's my impression, was their strongest policy message. And so now that appeals to young people who are working, getting started working. And I think that they were appealing toward, you know, concerns about like unemployment or again, wages for young families. But I think that was their angle in more than a, let's contrast sort of social spending for the young with the older people. The second thing I think helped them a lot was they ran a pretty successful social media campaign, and they were more active, I felt, than the other parties in a lot of ways on, you know, on various platforms and sort of going specifically after the youth vote. It isn't common, or you were talking about hinting at the demographic picture in Japan, right? Older people are making up a larger and larger share of the electorate. They turn out to vote at higher rates. They're much more likely to participate in election campaigns. They donate more to candidates. And so our picture of Japanese elections is often, parties going after the older people's vote or sort of competing over that. But it was interesting this time around that I think the DPP especially took a campaign strategy based in social media and consciously targeting younger voters more aggressively than we've perhaps seen in the past. So I think that's part of the story about why the DPP did so well, which is a little bit different than sort of some of my work about, maybe on more local politics, where we see younger candidates in particular as being successful by campaigning on sort of social benefits or social spending benefits, right, for younger families, as David was saying.
Yeah, no, it's going to be, well, it already is super interesting research, and it's going to be a great book pretty soon, I assume.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
So, maybe we can wrap up by just taking a little bit of a step back. At the Center for Asian Democracy here, we spend a lot of our time looking at really fragile democracies, right? Questions of
Yeah.
democratic backsliding it's tough times for democracy in much of the world, including in much of Asia. And so for that reason, sometimes Japan slips through the cracks, right? Because it's
Yes.
seen as
Yeah.
the high achieving kid in the class, right, in the region. There's good reason for that. That's still true. But I'm curious, sort of, even really consolidated democracies obviously face their challenges these days. And so what when you step back and think about the result from this election, what do you think it says about the overall health of democracy in Japan? I mean, weakening traditional political parties can sometimes create the opportunity for sort of more disruptive actors to come in, maybe even extreme actors to come into politics. But at the same time, shaking up a dominant single party system, in theory, should give more opportunities for real representation and contestation over voters and responsiveness to voter concerns. How do you view this result in terms of the overall health of democracy in the country?
Yeah, thank you so much, David. I think I'll focus on two bigger points or two bigger takeaways. So one, getting at really like the question you're talking about is, for a lot of us who get to teach about, say, Japanese politics, for example, in the classroom, we often raise this question about, of course, as you said, there's one image of Japan as being, maybe one of the most advanced liberal democracies in the region. But the flip side to that is that since 1955, you have one party winning almost every single election and almost, continuously staying in government. And so in the classroom, we raise this question about how do we view democracy without competition, to sort of quote Ethan Shiner's book title, for example. Is this a healthy democracy when you don't have competition? And so I think, there is something interesting to be said about this time around, that competition in the long run could be healthy for Japan's democracy. It could lead to, newer voices coming forward, newer ideas, making parties as a whole, say, more responsive to voters. But I think in the short term, what a lot of us, say, in the US will worry about is sort of like instability, right? That this is the challenge, right? We say that it would be great to have competition, or we say it would be great for the LDP to be sort of pushed by or face opposition from other parties. But then as soon as it happens, everybody in sitting in and maybe particularly in like Washington, D.C., for example, who works with Japan, is kind of like, well, no, but we're used to working with the LDP, right? We know all these people. Like, they're our friends, or we just had this I'm sorry, I'm pivoting to foreign policy, but
No,
we're
it's good.
coming off this we're coming off this really successful, I think viewed in the US and among our allies, viewed as very successful period of, locking in all sorts of cooperation on the US-Japan side, on the trilateral side between US, Japan, and South Korea. And, I think there was a lot of attention on sort of like taking advantage of this moment where we have agreement and building longer lasting institutions. And a lot of this is sort of premised on the idea of there being kind of stability on the Japanese side. And so this unexpected instability, even if it's maybe healthy for the functioning of Japan's democracy in the long term, I think is making people in the US maybe just a little bit queasy or like uncertain about what comes next. That's of course completely unfair given what's happening here next week. And we're talking about the uncertainty created by Japan's election. And I think we're talking orders of magnitude different than what we're facing here in the US. So I think we'll see. We'll see about whether this is a short-lived thing or something more fundamental about sort of a change to Japan's party system. And I'll end by just maybe saying, I think on the more pessimistic side, I hate to say it, but more pessimistic side, but I do worry about this. I mean, it's my focus area. I do worry about this like lack of youth representation, of getting back to something David was talking about earlier, political disengagement among young people. I mean, Japan faces a host of very, serious challenges, and it's really at the forefront of this like global trend in population aging, and has to deal with all these really tough policy questions about how is a shrinking base of younger people going to somehow support the growing welfare costs of this rising elderly population, and as it's facing all these big choices, young people aren't like turning out to vote, and they're not like sitting at the table, right? And so I'm concerned about what this means for like the direction of public policy, the degree to which policymakers will focus on issues important to young people. Social spending is one of them, but we didn't even get a chance to get into some of the, say, more like liberal social issues like gay marriage or women being able to keep their surnames after getting married that are really popular among the public and especially among young people. They're very popular among young people, but the like politicians aren't, addressing these issues. And so it makes me a concern. And so it really, just makes me concerned, I think, for the future that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to sort of, get younger voices feeling like they're engaged in the political process, feeling like representatives care about issues important to them, and making sure these voices are included. And again, I want to highlight that this isn't just something important to young people, but I see again and again in my work that all people in Japan or the general public would just like to see more age diversity, like to see more young people, coming to the fore with the creative solutions they have about how to deal with these really difficult problems. So I think I'll end there.
Yeah, well, and it's also obviously an issue that's relevant nearby in South Korea, right? And much more broadly to the future of democracy. So important to be bearing it in mind. And thanks so much again for taking the time, Professor Charles McLean of Yale University, to join us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
For those listening towards the end here, thanks for being with us. As always, keep your eye on the pod feed, either through Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or however you get your pod news. We'll have new episodes coming in coming weeks. We do also have in person, for those in the Louisville area, an event coming up before Thanksgiving that will focus on authoritarianism and politics in the Philippines in particular, but more broadly, with intellectual historian Vince Raphael, which we're very excited to be doing in the coming weeks. So keep your eye on our social media or websites for details on that. There will be a live stream also available for that, for those who are interested in viewing that way. Until then, thanks much, and we'll talk to you next time.